Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Welcome to this week's FX Podcast. I'm Mike Seymour. In July, it was announced that the series John Adams had received 23 Emmy Award nominations, the most of any program this year. Now, among those nominations, it had one for Outstanding Special Visual Effects Work for Miniseries. Actually, I got nominated for that myself a couple of years ago, so a lot of respect for anyone that gets nominated in this category. In a second, I'm going to speak to Jeff Goldman, a VFX supervisor at Cafe FX, about their Emmy-nominated work on John Adams. Cafe FX was actually the lead facility, along with others like Digital Backlot. They did amazing work on this miniseries, John Adams. There's just one thing I wanted to communicate first. This is a miniseries about the second president of the United States of America, John Adams. Now, this is somebody I didn't even know of as an Australian prior to this miniseries. Not only that, but when I did a little bit of hunting around, it seemed to be that he was pretty much regarded as about the most boring president going. And yet I found this miniseries absolutely fascinating. It really was phenomenally interesting and really, really well made. This guy was like one of the most influential founding fathers in the sense that he was behind the Declaration of Independence. And in fact, the miniseries covers decades of American history from just before the Declaration of Independence right up until the time of John Adams' death. And I didn't even realize that John Adams' son had become yet another American president. At so many levels, this was like a phenomenally interesting story. But, you know, who'd have thought it going in? It seemed like it would be far from it. And I just full credit to the filmmakers and to Cafe FX for bringing to life what is, as I say, otherwise been, I think, a sort of overlooked part of history. So we'll get to that interview in one second. Before that, I just wanted to give you a quick rundown on some of the other stuff going on around FX Guide. The other guys, Jeff and John, are in IBC at the moment in Amsterdam, and they'll be reporting there both in the written section of FX Guide and also with some special FX Guide TV episodes. The current FX Guide TV episode, actually, is an interview I did with Ben Grossman of The Syndicate. Ben is a phenomenally interesting guy, and we talked about his work with Rolling Stones, Martin Scorsese, and an amazing Radiohead spot using LiDAR scanning, which I must admit I'd sort of missed the full significance of it when it first came out, and then I sort of came across it and was stunned at the work that they'd done. It's a really beautiful piece. Not only is it phenomenally interesting, but as we mentioned in that interview on FX Guide TV, they actually gave away the data sets of the LiDAR scan, and Google has a flash module, I think it is. You can actually bring up those data sets and play with them and interactively move them around. So that's pretty interesting. I'm going to talk to you about some other podcasts we do here at FX Guide, including Red Center that I do with Jason Wingrove, where we look at digital cinematography. And the next Red Center finds Jason and I actually on set of an anamorphic red shoot discussing anamorphic lenses on the Red One. And then Jason has an amazing interview with a staff sergeant in the Air Force who's taken a red into a theater of combat. And his footage and his experiences of shooting literally in a war zone with the red are just extraordinary. Anyway, that's all on our other podcasts, and you can find everything at fxguide.com. Well, let's cross now to the interview that I did with Jeff Goldman, Cafe FX visual effects supervisor, on John Adams. Now, John Adams was produced by Tom Hanks' production company. Tom Hanks' production company was behind films like Band of Brothers for HBO and The New Pacific, which is just finishing up in post-production. So I asked Jeff what it was like to work with Tom Hanks and the amazing production company and team at HBO.
Actually, Tom Hanks is more of the sort of the executive producer on sort of for Playtone with the project, and we were sort of recommended by another VFX company who worked on it, and the VFX supervisor, who Eric Henry, who we've worked for many times in the past, so we have a relationship with him.
That relationship with the visual effects supervisor is so important going forward, isn't it? Because on these larger projects, you really need. It's terribly beneficial if you can work with somebody that you know and trust.
Yeah, this is probably our fifth, I think, show with him, and so he goes back to, you know, some older projects, Battlefield Earth and stuff, and so it there is a definite level of trust there. We know how the other person works. He likes coming up here, and we like seeing him, and it's a good way to work, I think, to try and surround yourself with sort of people who you can create relationships with over more than one project.
I mentioned the producers only because I guess with feature films, we're used to the director being the driving force, and it seems with a miniseries or television work that it's more of a producer's medium because, you know, directors, sometimes there are more than one director used on a project. Was that the case with this project? Was there a series of directors, or did you have the one director throughout?
No, this was actually one director, and that's sort of what made it, for us especially, we sort of typically do more feature work on the film side. In fact, I don't think we've ever done any television work other than this project. But even with this project, we approached it much like a very long feature film. It was one director throughout. It was 7 episodes, but it was always one guy at the helm, and we were always the producers weren't really involved with the creative so much. They may have been sort of more on the production side, but the director certainly was carrying the reins there.
So if you think of it like a feature film, and that's obviously a good way that you had to work, but that's a heck of a long feature film.
Yeah, no, it is. Our sort of side alone, we did about 330 shots, which is significant, I guess, for a television series. But, HBO likes to say that they're not television, they're HBO. and the sort of the film, I think, process, we our entire pipeline was full, 2K Cineon, so that we could go to a film market. Sometimes they'll take this miniseries and run it in another part of the world as a film market because there's not much of a cable market. So we had to do everything in a way that would ensure the quality on film, and they cut that way. So, for us, for all intents and purposes, it was like working on a feature film. Except we sort of had these, we had to, this episode was due at this point, then the next episode was due a few months later. And that staggered delivery was a little different.
So presumably in some markets it's also shown in HD, which is relatively close to 2K in terms of frame size.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we actually have a sort of a bigger, usually when we're doing sort of, let's say, action features, we're getting a smaller frame because of the 2.35 framing. So with HD, we have to ensure the 1.78, which is, the size of a regular HD television. So resolution-wise, you're virtually the same thing. The color space differs. Film has a lot more latitude, and we have to worry about our ranges a lot more outside of what you can see on a monitor or on an HD monitor. So we had to ensure that was still good for DI purposes or for a film market or something. So that differed from television a bit.
And of course, it was shot on film because I believe the production shot a couple of million feet of film, right?
Oh yeah, no. The director was very fond of. He wanted to sort of create an air of being there, like you were a witness to this event. So he had at times three cameras going for 10 minutes. When he'd let rolls run out and shot. I think I heard 4 million rolls of film at one point, which has got to be an immense amount to edit through.
One of the things I found interesting watching it is that while it isn't what you'd call a fast cutting kind of MTV style, it certainly has some interesting camera work. Not least of which is there is quite a lot of use of Dutch tilts and pretty wide angle lenses. There were quite a few shots where there were very wide angle lenses for a narrative drama. And I was wondering how that played into your ability to do 3D tracking for what must have been a large amount of set extension work.
It was challenging. I mean, we didn't have a whole lot of markers on set for various reasons. One, Eric Henry did a great job on set, and he was on set for the supervision, and he's who we answered to. But at the same time, this guy's got the director had three cameras going, and we didn't know what direction he'd be facing at any given time. So it was more important for him to get the performance of the camera and the performance of sort of the scene than for the visual effects. So it was quite a challenge having to track. And we used a bunch of tools for that. We've used, we use Buju a lot. We use a 3D equalizer, which I think was probably more used on this. It allows for a lot more hand customization, hand sort of automated hand tracking. And then I guess brute force, seeing if you can match it up by moving things by hand and seeing it by eye, the old-fashioned way. We had this, the most common lens used was a 14.5mm lens, which created quite a bit of distortion that we had to remove. So it was a bit tricky.
So I was going to ask you about that, whether the pipeline was to do 3D tracking, remove the distortion, and then presumably a lot of the buildings and stuff were CG, or were they matte paintings?
It was a combination. I mean, they built a really nice back lot on a mountain in Virginia, sort of a bare mountain surrounded by trees. And they had, for some reason, the art department budget only allowed for up to two-story buildings, so no buildings had roofs. And there were a few buildings that went to three or four stories. So we had to actually augment all of those buildings to include additional stories. So not only creating buildings from scratch, because there were also big gaps with their green screens, but also extending existing stuff. And it was sort of a weird combination of historic accuracy. Some of it was historically accurate, some of it wasn't. We tried to be as historically accurate as we could in the visual effects for the extension stuff that we could do, where buildings didn't exist at all. But the on-set stuff wasn't exactly super historic. If you look at old documentation of what, say, Boston looked like back then, certain buildings weren't in the right places. So we had to sort of ride the fine line of becoming extremely accurate and sort of artistically there.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's a narrative drama and not a documentary, but it had a real air of visual authenticity, which lent, I think, you know, in a lot of different ways. I mean, I noted with some interest at the end of the film that the actors' teeth were, like, appalling. And it's not something you normally do to actors. So there was certainly a sense of getting to the sort of gritty reality of what might have happened as opposed to sort of a glossy version. And you did quite a lot of research, right?
Yeah, we definitely did. We had books, and we found out there's actually not a whole lot of visual documentation. There's lots of documentation of architecture in history and stuff, so that's how we sort of created our buildings. There's a lot of stuff that still stands in Boston as sort of heritage buildings now, which helps. But, for instance, the Boston Massacre was one scene that we really wanted to get iconically as sort of an accurate representation, and there's, I think, one illustration by Paul Revere of that that was actually done by another artist and then redone by Paul Revere, but it's the only visual representation of that event, I think, that exists. It's the only one we found, anyway.
And if it was sort of difficult to find all the right reference material for Boston, you also had to deal with France and England.
England, France, and Philadelphia. The stuff in England we shot, that was the stuff that required the most work. France was Bulgaria, areas of Bulgaria subbed in for France, and we had to modify some of the Bulgarian palaces that the crew shot at, because they have these sort of very Bulgarian architecture. So those buildings were modified to look more French. A lot of big bulbous protrusions that were architectural, Bulgarian architectural designs were removed, and we modified them to be more French-like. And for England, we substituted some existing historical buildings for the real counterparts back then. There was a sequence in St. James Place, for instance, that it takes place entirely on green screen, where we shot the green screen stuff in a set in Bulgaria, but created all the rooms and the interiors by shooting photography in London.
And so that was one of the few scenes you got a chance to really previs, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was actually probably the most enjoyable part of it. It's when the VFX side can really work hand-in-hand with production, everything tends to go really smoothly. So they knew they couldn't shoot in the actual palace, yet they could take still photography of it. So Eric Henry went out, took some still photos, came back to us. We built the set based off of architectural dimensions, set up virtual cameras, several of them, and worked out some camera moves so that the director could see what the composition of the scene would look like. And then, luckily, he sort of stayed pretty close to those camera placements. And then when we got the footage back on green screen, here's a bunch of people walking around, and we plugged in what we had done with the previs and made it better, used higher quality textures and models, and it all sort of lined up and worked out really well.
Now, one of the things I was really intrigued about was getting to those places in the story involved a rough sea voyage. And it seemed to me that nearly everyone would approach this with, like, large gimbals and stuff. But you guys had to work without the benefit of doing that. Wasn't it most of the movement and stuff in that shot just done through camera moves?
All camera moves and you know, additional sort of background movement in our CG. That sequence actually was, I don't think, ever originally supposed to be in the story. I think the director really wanted it, and HBO only allowed him to shoot it over a period of a day. So he had to knock off, you know, 100 shots in a day, which is pretty amazing. But it didn't allow very much time to set up green screens and be effective there. So that was probably one of the more challenging sequences for us. And over the course of time, they went out and shot some. Eric again went out and shot some footage of water from a boat to give us some background plates to work with. We had a choice on whether to go with digital water or the real thing. And over time, that sequence got rougher and rougher as far as, you know, more stormy, and he wanted it to be more, you know, North Atlantic and very rough, and that's not what we had originally shot. So we had to go to a stock footage library, basically use the footage that they used for Master and Commander. apparently, you know, they shot rolls and rolls of stormy stuff there, and it's available for filmmakers to use in their works. And we couldn't quite find what we needed because they never shot with a wide 18-millimeter lens. So we had to sort of mosaic a whole bunch of water together to create this stormy condition. And it works out, I think. But all that stuff, that set was static and half-built and shot on the top of a mountain in Virginia.
Well, in addition to that, there were like cannonballs and smoke, and like it's quite a, you know, quite a action sequence, as it were.
Water splashes.
Yeah,
it was pretty intense.
So that sounds like a pretty serious compositing job to stitch together water, stock footage, and plates, and all those different elements. What was the compositing pipeline?
Well, at the time we were using Digital Fusion, or what they call Fusion now, for our compositing package, and it at the time had 3D camera capability, still does. So that sort of helps our compositors take a little load off of our 3D guys. It allowed them to stitch plates in 2D. You'd be surprised at how much you can get away with soft masking water together. It sort of all moves together, and you don't really notice the seams if you do it well. And then we would reproject that onto virtual planes that were tracked into the scenes to get the perspective we needed. It worked out pretty well.
But even getting those virtual planes sorted out must have been complex, because obviously they don't track to the ship. The ship rolls independently of those. So there's quite a lot of artistic sort of eye needed to pull off those shots, isn't there?
Yeah, and that's sort of something that goes back and forth with the director on how roll-y does he want it, how much, you know, I guess he wanted to create a sort of sense of vertigo and people could get sick, and John Adams was very sick on that voyage. So we probably put it a little over the top, but dramatically I think it works pretty well. But once we have that solid base, once we have everything matched up statically, then it's pretty much just rolling our virtual camera independently of the live action one.
And you're talking before about the large green screen sets which were built in Hungary. Again, what was the compositing on that? Was it all the whole project done on Fusion?
Yeah, definitely. It was all Fusion. The sets were generated in 3D. We use XSI for that. Softimage is XSI for that. And it was a combination of built geometry that matched the dimensions of the locations and projected photography for the textures. And well, the nice thing about that is we sort of got a boost from the lighting that existed in the room already. We augmented that to sort of smooth it all together, but there's nothing like real-world lighting.
And it was also XSI that you used on the kind of charming hot air balloon sequence, correct?
Right, the sequence that takes place in Paris, the Montgolfier balloon sequence. So that was a sequence that documented the first, I guess, free flight of man in a hot air balloon. And that was another sequence that was challenging. They had shot that in Hungary in a field with, I'm going to say, 50 extras in a group, with the original intention being to clone the 50 actors into thousands. And when we got the plates back, once we found out what the picks were from the director, which were, again, very handheld and very, very, you know, live, we found out that method was absolutely not going to work. So we quickly had to restructure a pipeline into 3D generated characters. So we did a combination of mixing the live action guys that are there for one section and duplicating them in CG. We actually got our hands on some of the costumes that were used and did a little shoot up here with some people up here to get about 15 variations of people in costumes that we then modeled in CG, applied motion capture movement to. Combination of hand-drawn animation and motion capture. to populate that scene.
It seems to me that that scene is indicative of what makes, I'm not going to say hard, but challenging in something like this episodic drama, because it's spread over a long period of time. And that scene is tremendously charming and interesting, but it's not as if we're coming back to that location or that scene any other time. It seems to me that, that you can end up having to invest quite a lot of work in a relatively short sequence, and it's not a reusable thing. It's not like the whole... Like we spoke about the water.
Right,
there was only one water sequence. There was only one hot air balloon sequence with crowds. I mean, in that that balloon sequence, which, as I say, was really charming, that felt nothing like a field. There was a lot of people. The backgrounds were quite complex. The balloon itself, I presume, was an effect.
It was primary live action. Sometimes it was digital, but it was primary live action. It was on a crane that they could lift it up and drop it.
And you had like presumably fairly large matte paintings behind that crowd.
Yeah, all of Paris back there in the 1700s was a matte painting, and the Tuileries Palace, which has long since burned down. Actually, it was. The other side of the Louvre, which doesn't exist now. So a lot of research had to go into figuring out what that looked like. Again, if you look at etchings from all throughout history, apparently those gardens and the building has looked different quite a bit. In fact, the artistic representations, historical representations of that event vary from, you know, a couple thousand people watching the event to tens of thousands of people watching the event. So, you know, we did some variations where we had fewer people and more people and more garden and less garden. And we ultimately settled where it ended up, which was pretty packed.
Is that like, you know, this whole idea of having to do sort of intensive, unique work for one particular sequence? Does that mean that you tend to set up teams that, look, will you just take that whole thing and just complete it? Or is it still you're going to be a pipeline where... because, you know, it seems to me that these are areas that need their own research, their own asset development, their own models, of course. How do you sort of structure that internally?
We do it with little teams, little fire teams, basically. We broke up the work. You know, with our building extension, that stuff sort of happens over and over throughout the 7 episodes. So we've got a team doing that and looking at it throughout the whole episode, or all of the episodes. And the Montgolfier balloon sequence was also one that was done by another small team. Sometimes the members of the teams overlap, but they're definitely concentrating on these little things. You have to do it that way, otherwise it gets very, very confusing.
And then the schedule was such that you managed to roll these out in order as per EPS, or did you have to sort of complete everything before the first one aired?
Everything was completed before the first one aired. I think we were a good month away on the final delivery to when it first aired. I think HBO just wanted to shut down production at that point to save money before getting to the air date. They also wanted to delay the air dates to the time of the conventions for the presidential candidacies and sort of get some political sort of PR from it and everything, get people excited about the process. So while initially the goal was to deliver episodes in chronological order, there are certain episodes that, especially earlier episodes, that have significantly more shots than later episodes. So by the end, a lot of episodes were being delivered at the same time, or episode 6 was delivered before episode 7. It depended on how much work was left, how much complication there was. That Montgolfier balloon sequence was actually the last sequence we delivered, even though it was in episode 4, I believe.
So in terms of like handing those shots over, this really felt like a feature film? In other words, you just were... You know, handing off shots, and then it went into a DI, and then and finally episodically packaged and delivered.
Yeah, our pipeline. We delivered Cineons, 2K Cineons to the DI. They did their work.
So I guess the question is, with the hindsight or the power of hindsight, how did it differ looking back than when you started the project?
I think you always go in hoping for the best, and that certainly did turn out pretty well. I think maybe the hardest thing was rolling with the punches, so to speak. If sort of the work was initially supposed to be fairly simple, we'd get our hands on the plates and it would be more difficult, and that sort of inevitably happens. Yet I find myself falling into the trap, production after production, going, oh, this is going to be easy. And then you say, oh, wait, maybe it's not going to be so easy. But a lot of what we're doing now in addition to the artistry of the work, is also just trying to fix things that happened in production that didn't necessarily have to, but because of the, you know, the complications and the cost of production, inevitably end up happening. The whole comment of the popular comment of fix it in post has never been more active as it is today. But that's just, that's part of the job. We enjoy the challenges, and we understand why you can't get it right the first time, necessarily.
Give me some, just in finishing up, give me some scope on the, like, how long did it work? Was it in post-production with you guys? And also, just how big was the team that you ended up having to devote to these sort of 320-odd shots?
I think we were in production on it for about 8 months, and overall, we had... it varies. The number of people who work on it varies over time, depending on what the workload is and the delivery schedule is. But I think we had about 50 people involved with it, which isn't a huge crew. It was actually a really nice sized crew. It was a very intimate crew.
It must be nice once the project's, you've got some distance from it, because obviously one of the reasons we're talking now is the Emmy nomination. It must be nice very to nice. Be recognized by your peers.
Definitely, definitely. That's always the icing on the cake. Yeah, I don't think going into any of this that we were even thinking anything like that, and then we heard about it, and it was kind of nice. And so, you know, I won't lie and say it was an easy production. It was definitely a challenging production. It was a fun, enjoyable production, but it was definitely challenging. So to sort of be recognized for pulling off that challenge is tremendous.
I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk to us, because I really think it's a terrific project, and, you know, for those people that maybe aren't in the US that haven't seen it, I think it's available on DVD now. But it is a terrific series of shows, and builds incredibly well over what must be about, 40 or 50 years over the course of the...
It's his political life from, I think, probably his late 20s to his death. It's pretty full. Definitely a good 7.5 hours worth of solid material. I'm glad you liked it. We enjoyed working on it, and we love that people like the work. I think that's actually, you know, that makes you feel real good when people like the work. So,
well, I thought it was great. Yeah. Thanks so much for talking to us, Jeff.
Hey, thank you.
Well, that's it for this week, but if you'd like to see some of the images we discussed or the green screen shots, I posted those in a story on the main site. Also, keep an eye out for stuff coming from Jeff and John from Amsterdam. They'll be posting and, of course, putting out more FX Guide TV apps. If you want to give us some feedback, post in the bottom of those stories, or alternatively, just follow us on Twitter. I'm on Twitter as Mike Seymour. Jeff's on Twitter as Neon Marg, as in NEONMARG, as in Neon Margarita. Neon Marg. And John is there as John Mont FX. Well, thanks so much for being with us this week, and we'll catch you next week. Thanks so much. See ya.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.